Our first speaker is Tom Hinckley, who's going to be talking, faculty in the College of Forest Resources, going to be talking on small to large scale issues in plant water use. Okay.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. I don't think I've ever been so wired. I've got two microphones. I sound like I'm coming from six directions up here. So my apologies as this talk unfolds. I'm going to tell you what I consider some of the really more recent or newer issues regarding water and plants. And I'm going to start at a small scale and go to much larger scales in this particular talk. I'm going to start at the sort of tree stand level, and then we'll move up to much larger scale. So the first bullet really, I think, deals with the obvious. I think anyone that works with vegetation understands their role in the hydrologic cycle, and this is just, in a sense, a review. And it also includes some statistics regarding or some numbers regarding the quantity of water used by either understory plants or overstory plants, at least what we know for the west side of the Cascades and much of north of America. The other three sort of interesting tree stand level things include nighttime transpiration, hydraulic redistribution, and the interaction between forest structure and fog, cloud, and rain. The nighttime transpiration has come to a fore, and the reason why it's so important is one of the major techniques for looking at large-scale fluxes from systems, the eddy covariance technique, totally misses this particular feature. And so nighttime transpiration in many different forest systems and grassland systems can be appreciable 10 to 22% of the total daily water loss. I'm going to spend a little bit of time talking about hydraulic redistribution, going from the soil to, in a sense, going way up in scale to some data from the Amazon. And I'm also going to talk about the interaction between fog and cloud and trees. The other important sort of forest structure and hydrologic modification, as witnessed in whether it was the Olympia newspaper, the Seattle newspaper, or the New York Times, was some logging endeavors, let's say, around the Chehalis area and some associated high water. Hydraulic redistribution is really a unique phenomenon that was first noted by Marty Caldwell and Jim Richards at Utah State University in Sagebrush in the late 80s, and they documented this in a sagebrush system. Since that time, it's been unraveled or uncovered in a whole range of different woody plant species, including now Douglas fir and western hemlock and ponderosa pine. The question is what is it? For those of you who sort of have a traditional background in plant-water relations, this is the classical view of how roots, stems, and leaves and the atmosphere interact from the water cycle. Roots uptake water, stems, branches, petioles transport the water, leaves lose the water, and that system goes on night and day, and during the night there's rehydration of the plant, and that ends the story. But what Caldwell and Richards uncovered was that at night, once the plant had rehydrated, deep roots from sagebrush took up water, but instead of distributing them into the upper part above ground, they distributed them into the surface roots. The surface roots, because the gradient in water potential went from the roots to the soil, actually distributed the water back into the soil. Since that time, it's gone from not only hydraulic lift, this is the lifting phenomena that you see here, but it includes now hydraulic redistribution, that is, lateral roots that are in moist or wet areas can move, transport water into roots that are in dry areas. And in a sense now, the root is regarded as an organ of the plant, at least the xylem of the root, where you can get bidirectional water movement. And in fact, there's evidence that tap roots, you can move water from following rainstorms from the surface of the soil down deep into the soil through the role that tap roots play. So how important is this process? And from the tree standpoint, from an ecosystem standpoint, it appears fairly important. And then we'll get to some data regarding the potential larger scale important in the Amazon. It generally occurs at about the point when soil moisture content and water potential, you start to reach the break point where a change in soil water content results in a large change in soil water potential. That's when hydraulic lift starts to be observed and starts to increase in importance. Never a lot of water is moved. And for example, it's usually less than 0.35 millimeters per meter of forest soil or soil zone per day. And it replenishes around 30% of the water that's lost. So there's a whole list of reasons for why this might be important. Everything from maintaining live roots near the surface, maintaining decompositional mycorrhizal connections, enhancing actually water use or water loss during the day in the plant. So there's a whole range of different hypotheses that are available for why this might occur. And interesting, a paper that appeared in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences suggested that at large scale, hydraulic lift, some of the trees in the dry tropical forest and wet tropical forest of the Amazon have roots that go to 15 and 20 meters. And during like an El Nino year where it will be really dry in the tropics, this can be a really critical source of water. And not only is it a critical source of water, this lift towards the surface wets the litter near the surface, wets understory plants that may be utilizing this water during the surface, and as a result of this, at a large scale, may provide increased sort of latent heat or source for latent heat of evaporation of water and may keep air moist. It may also prevent fires that start in the farms and ranches around the dry tropical forest from proceeding greatly into these forests too. So it's an important process. Fogs in redwoods. This is a story that's been unraveled by Todd Dawson, Steve Sellett, and Koch. This is a group from Northern Arizona University, University of California at Berkeley, and Humboldt State University. And one of the plants that they've worked on is this stratosphere giant that not so many years ago, I think there's now one tree taller than this, was the tallest tree in the world. In the environment where coastal redwood grows, fog is an important sort of ecological determinant of the productivity and the success of that environment. And if you look at the summer rainfall pattern, where during the summer we have a typical Mediterranean rainfall pattern as such as we have here, during that same time, fog becomes ecologically more important. And you can see in this, so here's we actually have a visual fog. You can see in this particular chart here where there's a comparison between collecting both rainfall and fog in an open environment inside of a forest and in an open fog collector and in an open area. You can see if we contrast these two extremes, so in the forest versus in an open, say a shopping mall parking lot, we have this much precipitation in both input in both systems. Fog input provides an additional 34%. And fog drip then comes, the way I look at it, is the foliage of these large trees and the complex structure that results from this old growth structure is analogous to the baleen that whales have. It collects the cloud and fog as it comes in, condenses. As the condensation reaches a certain critical mass, drops come on the forest floor. And in a sense, the whole system benefits from this. And in fact, the evidence that comes in this benefit has come from some really nice stable isotope work that Todd Dawson and his group have done. There's also evidence from Burgess and Dawson of some direct uptake of fog from the leaves. We know for also Pacific silver fir, there's direct uptake, hydrologically unimportant, physiologically very important. So we have an axis here showing the stable isotope of hydrogen. It's becoming more negative here. This is January over here. This is the beginning of the summer. This is December over here. This is the pattern of the stable isotope value for rainfall, showing the most negative value in the middle of towards the end of winter, and then increasing the summer. So this is the pattern of rainfall, and you notice during this particular time here, the plant water use component shows a similar value, indicating that the plants are getting most of their water from the soil at this particular time. Fog results in a pattern, stable isotope pattern, that looks like this for the fog water content. And you will notice that during the summer dry period, that some of the plants, sword fern being a great example, gets 100% of its water from fog drip, not from soil moisture. So this is really an important part of what drives this ecosystem. And the reason for mentioning it is a concern about climate change, land use changes that result in changes in cloud distribution and changes in fog, both the timing of fog and its spatial distribution. All right, larger scale issues. We're going to start with sort of forest stand water use and stream runoff, some work from Tim McDonald down at Oregon State University. Bugs, trees, and climate change. It's a sort of just north of the border story that's likely to be a south of the border story before long. And then increases in base flow as a result of an increase in water use efficiency. Several recent papers that appeared in Nature. So we're going to follow those. All right, so McDonald, and if any of you are interested in this, the Northwest Forest Soils meeting that was held at the end of January, his PowerPoint from that is available online at Rob Harrison's website. So I'm just going to borrow. This is just one slide from some 50 slides that he had talking about this particular topic. So there's an assumption. This is sort of a driving assumption, a hydrologic assumption, that is water at a given slope location is a function of the upslope cumulative area to the point. And his argument is that this is a false assumption. There's this visual connection between stand water loss and hydrographs. So for a lot of the data that comes from the H.J. Andrews, for example, you will see daily increases in plant water use or forest water use in a watershed. At the same time, you see a decrease in the water flow from the hydrographs. So one makes then this sort of mental jump that there's a linked relationship between forest stand water loss and then the hydrograph itself. And what he actually observed and analyzed in the watershed, water falling in a watershed moves mostly vertically in the soil profile. The soil can get wet, that you have small lenses of very wet water that you get then saturated flow, but you don't get this sort of from top of the slope to the bottom of the slope kind of thing that I think, at least I felt, that was the way the system worked. Trees use mostly soil water. They don't use groundwater. And so if you look at stable isotope values, trees show soil water. The stream shows groundwater. And so there's a disconnect between these two systems. And he emphasizes stream water is mostly groundwater that has a surprisingly long residence time in the system. And his analysis shows what factors of gradient stream length are important in this. There was a recent paper from Colorado where they had Nature's Most Teflon Basin, where they analyzed input of rainfall into that basin with a hypothesis that it ought to behave like a bathtub, turn on the shower, the water goes out the drain instantly. There was something like a 6 to 8 month delay between water when it hit the surface and when it was actually showing up the signature was showing up in the stream system. So I think we're beginning to realize that there's a lot of residence activities occurring in wildland watershed systems. And I realize in 20 minutes I'm sort of running through things that one could spend a whole quarter having a course on, because these are really big topics. Bugs, climate change, and trees. This is a map from 2006 for British Columbia. This is the area that's been impacted. And had I not spent about a week with a group of students last fall in the Kamloops area, I don't think I would have quite believed the reports that I've heard from this part of the world. It's the new estimate for 2007, about 32 million acres have been affected and severely affected. This is an area the size of Louisiana. And it really is a result of the perfect storm. It's a combination of climate change factors, fire suppression management decisions, logging preferences for species, creating then this incredible, and site factors in creating this incredible array of foodstuff and an insect that's now surviving the winter and doing incredible damage to the lodgepole pine. Well, so you get pictures like this that unfortunately you're going to have to wait till you see a version of this, but this has got lots of red and orange in it. The important thing, this is a young stand of lodgepole pine, 25 years old. It's on former Weyerhaeuser. They sold this land. Former Weyerhaeuser land. It's been thinned. It's been pruned. It's got all the conditions that should not lead to bark beetle damage. Every tree, except for maybe 5%, is dead in this stand. These are ponderosa pine. It's an alternate host, but it's not typically regard. There's a ring of dead ponderosa pine in the elevational belt in this whole valley. They talk about when the beetle leaves the trees, you can actually see the movement of insects in British Columbia. There's so many of them flying at once. It's truly impressive. I want to suggest, and we'll come to the very conclusion slide, about the impact that this bark beetle and the death and mortality of these trees had. The final scale issue I want to talk about is, there was a paper by Chris Field in 1996 in Plant, Cell, and Environment, where he and others hypothesized that as a result of elevated CO2, that water use efficiency in plants would increase. And there's really good evidence for how this might happen. As a result of this, he suggested that plants would use less water. And there's two consequences of it. One consequence, Gidney, in an article that appeared in 2006 in Nature, and there's been subsequent publication by Gidney's group, which suggests that in an analysis of continental runoff from multiple continents, that there's been an increase in base flows as a result of plant water use efficiency. In other words, plants are slowing in their water use, and as a result, now there's more water available for stream flow. There's a whole series of subsequent publications that suggest that there's a large number of other factors, including increased precipitation, changes in land use, et cetera, that may be involved here. The other broader implication of Field's paper is trees use water loss as a cooling mechanism. At a mesoscale to macro scale, this could lead to, through stomatal closure, increased convective heat loss, which means warmer air, drier air, which then becomes a potential feedback mechanism for drier fuels for fire behavior. So, future climate, warmer, wetter winters, longer, warm season, drier summers. Future forests, largely unmanaged, dense, lots of mortality, fire suppression will continue. Insect and diseases, both non and native, will flourish. Competition for invasive plants will increase, and disturbances such as fire and landslides will result from this. And this has huge impacts in British Columbia to small communities, for example. And here's pictures from the Tripod Fire. And a lot of the intensity associated with the Tripod Fire was in lodgepole pine forests impacted by insects. So in this talk, we have very quickly looked at a wide range of water and associated implications for carbon exchange and carbon sequestration related issues, where we've gone from trees and stands all the way up to a regional scale. Thank you. Got that down to the nanosecond.
We've scheduled in 5 minutes for questions, and I'll just ask Tom to repeat the question after it comes.
Some hydrologists claim that evapotranspiration cannot exceed measured pan evaporation. Is that true?
All right, the question is that actual evapotranspiration cannot exceed pan evapotranspiration. I know, for example, in hybrid cottonwood trees growing in irrigated east side environments where I've seen the maximum rates of stand water loss. Problem is, I don't know what the pan rates were, but the tree rates were between 8 and 12 millimeters per day, which is double or more than double the kinds of rates that you would ever find on the west side of the Cascades, even during the sort of warmest, driest day. So I can't directly answer that question. Yes?
You were saying, or quoting McDonald, that the residence time of precipitation is a long scale, and that the rivers are fed by sort of deep groundwater, not shallow aquifers. Where is that study done? Because we've done stuff in the Walla Walla, and the resident time of surface water was a scale of 2 days. So where is he doing his work?
So all his work has been done in the H.J. Andrews, and he's done most of his work in Watershed 10, but he's done work in several other watersheds. And to me, the most important paper, and I can't remember if the name, if it's Matthews, from Colorado, he gave a paper at Chico Hot Springs in February of 2005 at the Mountain Climb meeting. And he talked about actually doing measurements in one of the basins up in the Front Range. And it was basically a rock-filled basin where one would hypothesize that water hitting the ground should be in the stream virtually like from a parking lot. And they were finding 6 to 8 months delays in the time for the water. So, I mean, this is one of the interesting things is how elastic or inelastic is this kind of system. McDonald's is using the stable isotope technique plus actual measurements of soil water at various depths to look at the connection between water coming into the system through precipitation and out through stream flow.
Okay.